Welcome to episode 6 of Shards of Light, Voices of the Blind and Vision Impaired, a showcase for the talents of the visually impaired citizens of Virginia. This project is funded in part through a generous grant from the Virginia Board of the Blind and Vision Impaired. My name is Lamont Crawley, founder and host. Monroe Law is the firm, and Robert G. Monroe is a star attorney. In fact, Rob is the firm's only attorney, but I can only assume that is by desire and design. But we will find out more. Hey, Rob, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Lamont, for having me.
We're going to start with some general information about your firm, and then I'm going to take you back to your childhood. And then as we come forward again, we're going to end with information related to you being a lawyer and such. Okay?
Very good.
This is a solo practice, a Monroe Law. Is that by design?
Yes, I started my practice in 2011. The end of June, beginning of July, which was the year after I graduated from law school. While I was waiting to take the bar exam, and there's another exam they make you take about professional ethics.
Okay.
I spent some time working with the Legal Aid Society for people who can't afford lawyers when they're accused or when they're being evicted from their house or need to declare bankruptcy or things like that. And then I followed some criminal attorneys around and decided that that was the best place to pick up work. My practice started off as being a general practice, doing any and everything. Over the years, I've come to concentrate on defending people in criminal cases.
After you got your law degree or passed the bar, you didn't work for no other firm.
No, I did not.
So that was a public position through the city, through the county?
The local legal aid group is called Blue Ridge Legal Services. They are a nonprofit, but they do have some employees. I was volunteering while I waited for my license to come through. Anything I did had to be under the supervision of a licensed attorney.
Okay.
Until I got my license in January of 2011, and then they didn't have a swearing-in ceremony before the Supreme Court of Virginia until that June, so I was able to start my own practice after that.
And what would be your pitch, if you will, to a potential client? Like, what is it that your firm is about?
I'm here to listen to the person who's accused and give them the best advice that I can. There are four decisions in a criminal case that nobody can take away from the defendant, which is what you call the accused person. Whether to hire a lawyer or represent themselves. There's a saying that a man who has himself for a lawyer has a fool for a client. I'll add that a lawyer who has himself for a lawyer has a very big fool for a client. But you can hire any lawyer that you want. If you're hiring the lawyer, if the court is appointing you a lawyer, then the court picks the attorney.
Sure.
The second decision is whether to insist on a trial and make the Commonwealth put on evidence against you, or to accept a plea deal if they offer to settle the case without going to trial. The third decision is at a trial. For felony trials are always in front of a jury unless you really convince the judge that a bench trial is the thing. But you can even get a misdemeanor in front of a jury if you appeal the lower court verdict. And then the last decision is whether to testify at the trial. You can stand up, say not guilty, sit down, and stay mute for the rest of the proceeding if you wish. So I explain that those are the four points where the client has the decisions to make. And other than that, if I take the case, I'm signing on to stand on the hill and fight where they tell me to.
Okay. All right. On your website, you have a slogan, small firm, big magic. What's the magic, Rob?
The practice of law is a helping profession. another word for attorney is sometimes advocate, and that's in Spanish, it's literally advocate. Someone to come in and speak for people who aren't good at speaking for themselves. They haven't been under pressure, and so might not be able to, or can't think clearly and objectively about the best way to do things. I provide that stable point of advice, and I will go in and argue for what the client wants. Prosecutors have a job, not only just, it's not going after convictions for them, they have to be ministers of justice. If there isn't evidence in a case, they're supposed to drop it. My job as a defense attorney is not what I think is best for the client, not what I think is really true. I'm not Perry Mason. I'm not a detective. My job is to go in and argue for what the client wants.
Okay.
And most of my discussions with people are, what do you want and why do you want it? And what is the strategy that we use? If someone is the only breadwinner and has minor children, they want to avoid jail at all costs, perhaps. Mm-hmm. So sure. Any plea deal with active jail time is a non-starter.
I got you.
If somebody already has felony convictions, they don't care if they have another one because they already are a felon. So that opens up possibilities there. If they don't wish to have a felony conviction, we might be able to argue the Commonwealth down to a misdemeanor if we're wheeling and dealing, but that might involve some active jail time.
Mm-hmm.
But if the Commonwealth doesn't offer a deal that the client can accept, the default answer is you go to trial. So you're always preparing for trial. And if a good enough offer comes along, well, that's great. Then we get off the expressway to trial.
Your explanation for a defense attorney, if you will, is it just yours or that's the general approach?
That is what the rules of professional conduct for the state bar say we must do.
Okay.
Sometimes you get a little pushback when you're in civil court where the other attorney is wanting you to settle and your client doesn't agree. And I've had attorneys tell me on the civil court, don't you have any client control? As if I could substitute my judgment for theirs and force them to accept the deal when I can't.
Right. Okay.
I don't have that authority.
Okay. Okay, so Rob, let's go back to your birth. You were born with an eye disease, as I understand it?
When I was 6 months old, I went in for a well baby checkup, and they spotted a white place in my eye, which turned out to be a tumor in the retina, the back part of the eye that connects up to your brain. And it turned out I had it in both eyes. So the fancy medical term would be bilateral retinal blastoma. They had to remove my right eye entirely. It was too far advanced. They managed to save the left eye, but the retina was partially detached. So I had some minor vision growing up.
Okay.
But retinoblastoma, it turns out, is a genetic disease. I didn't inherit it from anyone in my family. It was a new mutation with me.
Okay.
But one of my sons did inherit the gene. So we were watching him very carefully from the very beginning. And he, in fact, came down with it. We spotted it at age 5 weeks. So he had a much better outcome than I did in 1973.
Okay.
Partly because they have better medicines and lasers now, but also we were on it much, much earlier.
I see. Okay. Can you see at all? Is it low vision? Is it no vision?
I have nothing functional right now.
Mm-hmm.
Before I explain what it's actually like now, I did have enough functional vision to be on, the swim team, and I would be riding bikes around.
Okay.
Even though my field of vision was basically down and to the left, and no binocular vision at all. So
right.
I don't know how I managed to deal with things with no depth perception, but in any case, I got around pretty well. Then in the end of seventh grade, I had overlapping cases of chickenpox and pink eye, which wound up with a scar on my cornea in the lower left part, right where the field of vision was. So right now I have this sort of revolving disco ball of light in that place where the scar is refracting the light. Uh-huh. And it keeps changing color every so often.
Okay.
But it's in the way of whatever I could possibly see. So I have some idea of what shadow and movement might be, but it's not something I ever pay attention to because it's not reliable.
Okay. And did you attend public schools, private schools? What's the situation there?
In California, they had a sort of halfway system. There was a classroom where the visually impaired people went for a good part of the day, but they spent about half the day with a regular class. So I went first through fourth grade like that. Then when we moved to Virginia, I was in public school all the time with just a support person coming in to maybe type things up in Braille.
Okay.
Or make sure that handouts were enlarged mm-hmm. or read anything to me that wasn't available.
And
almost nothing was available on audio tapes back then. If it wasn't one of your classics of English literature, if it was anything specialized, you had to have somebody read it to you.
Okay. That leads into this question. From when you first started in your earlier years compared to today, there is a great difference in the amount of accessibility products out there today than what you had available to you, correct?
Absolutely.
I mean, I can only assume you're taking advantage of those now as well.
Yes, that's right. From computers and scanners, and the first iPhone that talked came out in 2009.
Okay.
And in 2019, there was the 10th anniversary of that. And so somebody did a count and decided that the iPhone replaced 32 different assistive technology gadgets that you would have had to use.
Oh, wow.
You know, one for reading what money was, one for making labels that you wanted to put in your clothes, another one for telling what color something was, and on and on it goes, that all phones just do.
I see. You know, I see. Okay.
Cassette player, record player.
Right. No, that's right. Okay.
Light and stylus. So my son was asking me just last night at dinner, as a matter of fact, he's getting ready to take his first, he's in third grade. Taking his first set of SOLs in Virginia. Okay. And what is the hardest test you ever had to study for? And what I finally came down to was a geography class in ninth grade.
Okay.
Where they would do something, they would hand all the students a map
right.
and then tell them the test was to color in the various things. Color in the Mediterranean Sea,
sure.
blue.
Okay.
Crosshatch Egypt in red.
Wow.
Things like that. And
yeah,
so they gave me extra time to take this test and a sighted person. But if I told them that Egypt was in the top right-hand corner of Africa, they would say, where's Africa?
Mm. Okay.
And they wouldn't even agree what was north.
Right.
It was, you have to go toward the top of the paper. The top of the paper is the side toward, they were getting that specific because they weren't supposed to help me at all. And this was in ninth grade in 1980.
Now, how frustrating was that? I mean, that's, yeah.
If you have to think that much about it, you're now engaged in human communications, not answering the question they're trying to test you on. And God help us with algebra. They could not teach me that to save their lives. They didn't know how to approach it. It took a rocket scientist from NASA to teach me math.
And look, in spite of all that, you got through that. In fine stead, I take it. I mean, you know, you seem very well balanced, of upbeat
person. B student.
Okay. When did you know or think that perhaps law would be a field for you?
It was said to me in sort of jocular fashion from time to time, you'd make a really good lawyer, because I would argue various points and so forth. But what actually did it, and I have to lead up to this answer a bit.
Okay, sure.
I went to college at James Madison University from 91 through 95, then started working in public radio at the local Harrisonburg, Virginia public radio station, WMRA, and also at the Valley Voice, the equivalent of a reading service for what the Virginia Voice is.
Exactly. Okay.
And I did that till 2004. And I got a little burnt out trying to raise money and fight the same old fights and explain again to the same people why it was important for blind people to have access to the daily newspaper. Because there was an internet back then that was ramping up, but all of the assistive tech was by no means anywhere close to what it is now. And it's still not keeping up with all the changes they make. So my brother at that time had done his own midlife career change. And at age 29, he enlisted in the National Guard and went back to school to get all the biology stuff he needed to become a doctor. So in 2004, he started at Duke. So I moved down to North Carolina and stayed with him for a little bit. And I discovered, and not for the first time, that if you don't work for a living, a government check doesn't go very far. So I was working for a couple of years at a place called LC Industries for the Blind in Durham, making mattresses that were sent to prisons and military bases and things like that.
Yeah.
And that was factory work, and I turned out to be good at it, but it was dull.
I gotcha.
I was going to law school because I was going away from factory work. There was a place right there in town that would help you study for the LSAT test that you would have to take to get into law school.
Okay.
So I took a course for that, got a reasonably good score on the LSAT, and got into 3 or 4 different law schools, and wound up going to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill because I was a Carolina resident at that time.
You're making all this sound like matter of fact. And I hear your drive, your persistence, your curiosity, your sense of adventure and exploration. Was it as easy as all that, as it feels listening to you?
No. Okay. It sounds very compact because I'm trying to explain clearly in a enough amount of time.
No, that's right.
But
that's
this
right.
all took years. And dealing with all of the frustrations of daily living as an adult, plus assistive tech and the strategies we use for coping with our vision situation, our vision loss and blindness. Around 2002, I had bladder cancer as a long-term side effect of the chemotherapy that was used to treat the retinoblastoma when I was an infant.
Okay.
So, from 2003 to 2006, you weren't really sure if that was ever going to come back, because they got it really early, and there was nothing to measure. There was no tumor left.
Absolutely.
But there, you know, am I in remission? Is it all gone? I did a big branching out, which is another reason my career ended at that point. But I met my now wife in 2003, and she was in Culpeper, Virginia.
Okay.
So we had kind of a long distance relationship going on. We got engaged in 2006 and married the summer right before I started law school.
Okay.
A very complicated situation. Lots of Greyhound buses going on and back and forth. And Denise would come down to Chapel Hill and so forth. Lots of plates in the air at any one time.
Absolutely. No doubt about it. And I'm trying to figure out how you did all that with limited vision on top of that.
Because now, I had to.
But that's the spirit, isn't it? You know,
I tried sitting at home and doing nothing. It didn't work.
Exactly. I got you. Life gives you what it gives you. What is any individual going to do with that?
I had to live what I was always telling people when I was running the Valley Voice, that a lot of people, as I believe you're aware from your own experience, have a vision loss later in life.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very common, especially the further back in time you go. Oh, well, grandma can't do anything anymore. We'll just have her sit around and we'll do everything for her. And she can't even dial a phone, whatever attitudes, right? And it's important to open the blinds and get some fresh air in. And information is that light and air that we're missing. And if you set artificially low limits for yourself, well, you're not going to have any kind of accomplishments.
Okay.
And I had to live that and live up to my own pep talks.
Exactly. So now, what are some of the, just in terms of negotiating the world as a younger adult with your vision impairment, you know, what were some of those challenges that you experienced?
Well, this is back before Uber was a thing. Well, well before Uber was a thing.
Okay, exactly.
And taxi cabs were not about the internet at all.
Right.
That's why Uber became a thing, because that industry did not keep up with what people wanted and did not have availability for people to use their smartphones to just easily get a cab and not just talk on the phone to a person.
Okay.
You're going to take a cab around, well, you need all that need to handle all the money, and you never know who you're going to get and how long it's going to take. And paratransit systems, I don't know what they're like in Richmond these days, but it was inconvenient to try and schedule things around the availability of those rides, and to have a medical appointment only to have the paratransit be an hour late, and now you've missed your appointment and all of that. So sometimes you wanted a cab for certain things, and then making sure you knew what the bus routes were. Fortunately, in Durham, I was within walking distance of a couple of three different bus stops, depending where I wanted to go. In fact, to get to work, the shift started at 7:30, but you had to be down to the downtown hub by about 6:15 to meet the bus that was going to take you to the factory. And I guess we all kind of got there about 7. And then left at 3:15, and then the bus would take you back. And then you'd have, so you wind up, I wound up leaving the house about 6:15 in the morning, getting back about 4:15 in the afternoon. That's a big drag. I had a guide dog at that time, so that, that helps keep you out of your rut. You have to get out of bed in the morning because Labrador has no snooze alarm. No snooze button.
That's right.
The logistics like that. Is there someone trustworthy to read me my mail?
Exactly. I got you.
There were scanners back then, but again, you have to have the computer set up working, and how quickly do they do things? Not like today at all. So it could be done if you had the time and the inclination. It was a lot easier to wait a couple times a week until my brother or roommate was around.
What year did you graduate from the law school?
In May of 2010.
Oh, okay. So you set up your firm within a year after graduating then?
13, 14 months.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's pretty quick. Very good. What made you come back from North Carolina to Harrisonburg, where you are currently located? Your law firm is located there as well.
As I believe I mentioned, my wife was in Culpeper and had friends in this part of Virginia. It's a depending how you go, perhaps an hour and a half drive from Harrisonburg, there's a great big mountain in the way, unfortunately. And her parents lived near Johnstown, Pennsylvania. And at that time, mine were living in Newport News, Virginia. Harrisonburg was in a part of Virginia that I knew, near where Denise had established friendships, and about halfway between our two parents. My parents upset that whole dynamic by retiring to Harrisonburg in 2012. About the time Denise was pregnant with our first child.
And I want you to know, I just discovered Johnstown, Pennsylvania last summer. I went up there with a friend to visit some family. Hadn't even heard of it prior to then. But I do love
fascinating history.
Yeah, I got a little bit of that, no doubt about it, from some of the folk there. Okay, so you came back, set up your law firm. Now, do you just practice right there within the Harrisonburg or the surrounding counties, or do you do cross-state kind of work, or what?
Within, say, about an hour's drive, I would I would go down to Stanton or Waynesboro. All the Augusta County courts are in Stanton. I've occasionally gotten down to Wythe County or Lexington, but mostly it would be from Stanton north up to Winchester and then maybe over to Charlottesville or Greene County. But that's about it. And Harrisonburg is in Rockingham County, and Shenandoah County is immediately north of us, Woodstock.
Now, do people, you just get walk-in clients as well? Or is it always through the courts?
Up until this February, it had been there was a steady stream of court-appointed work because Rockingham County and Harrisonburg did not have a local public defender's office. All of the private attorneys, well, as many who wanted to, would get on a list to receive court appointments, and the judge would just go through that list, and whoever was next up would get the next client. I have stepped up my game because they've now started the public defender's office. So I'm now trolling and getting a lot of referrals through websites like lawyers.com and that whole family of websites. And word of mouth people mm-hmm. get in trouble again, they call you again.
Sure.
Or
sure.
refer you to a friend. And I certainly have enough to keep me busy.
All right. And in that process, you also have done, I don't know if you currently do, volunteer work. Can you share a little bit about that?
The state bar encourages, it's not required, but you're encouraged to either do a certain amount of what's called pro bono work. Means mm-hmm. The big Latin phrase is pro bono publico, for the public good.
Okay.
Or if you're just too busy to donate, you know, the equivalent amount of what you would earn in the amount of time to your local legal aid society.
Right.
It's usually about 2% of your time or 2% of your income is kind of the suggested thing. Court-appointed work is not particularly well paid.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an old joke about a store owner who's lowered his prices on goods.
Okay.
And the shop owner next door asked him, how do you make money when you've lowered your prices so much? And he says, well, I lose money on every transaction, but I make it up in volume.
Okay. Okay.
Which, of course, is silly if you lose money on every transaction. But so that it was not called pro bono work. It was called low bono work. You were kind of, you were taking court appointed cases for people who couldn't afford it and not being paid your full hourly rate. And that was kind of gave you a pass.
Okay.
If you did enough of that, which I certainly did.
Sure.
I think I'm going to have to start figuring out what I can do for Blue Ridge Legal Services or donations to them, especially in the current climate.
Okay. I got you.
Public funding is drying up.
No, that's right. That's right. No doubt about it. And I think every day I'm, you know, more and more you begin to understand that trickle down effect across society of the drying up of monies, federal money and such. What talent do you bring to bear and that you might suggest would be useful for anyone to become a more effective and successful lawyer? What talents do you bring to your practice?
Focus.
Okay, focus.
There's a couple of quotes in mind. One is 80% of success is showing up. Be present and be early, because you can't be on time. You're either early or you're late. If you're on time, you're late.
That's right.
So be present for the job. You know, don't be thinking about other things, but keep your mind on what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And the rules of conduct say, you know, diligence and competence. You don't take a job where you don't know the law.
Okay.
Or if you do, you tell people that you're learning on the job and you charge them less money. Right.
Okay,
and then
right.
diligence is you put in the time thinking about the case and looking at all the evidence. And this all leads to the second quote, which I think started off with Voltaire, the old time French writer.
Mm-hmm.
I think the original was, no problem can withstand the onslaught of sustained thinking.
Okay.
I would substitute effort.
Right.
Keep at it. You're bound to achieve something. But the last gets back to what I was telling you, that the client sets the goals for what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
If the goal is, go get me the best deal possible, I'm not going to prepare for trial. That's not what the client wants.
Right.
Right? Just because on principle, everyone's entitled to a trial,
mm-hmm.
The client doesn't want that. So you have to redefine success with every case, even if you think that the facts are run-of-the-mill. I've had 6 like it this week, mm-hmm. another DUI, driving under the influence of alcohol. You have to approach everything with a fresh view, check all the things. Did this really happen in Rockingham County? Had they strayed over the line? Are we in the right court? Did they have their radar calibrated? Did they use the right testing mm-hmm. kits? Mm-hmm. Was this officer properly trained? Is he following the policies? You know, watch for all of those little red flags and listen to what the client is telling you as body camera footage becomes more and more prevalent. You have to sit through a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of feel sympathetic for the police listening to what they have to put up with. But sometimes it is frightening what they get up to.
Okay.
Because they feel their oats.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
And it can turn on a dime. So, but if you don't watch all the video, you're not going to spot the police foolishness. But I've had more than one case dropped simply because the prosecutor did not want that video played in court. In some jurisdictions around the country, Commonwealth's attorneys are not prosecuting all of the cases that they could. Here in Virginia, for instance, the locally elected prosecutors, the Commonwealth's attorneys, are not required to prosecute misdemeanors. They're required to prosecute felonies. In some jurisdictions, the police have to be the ones to present their own evidence. The prosecutor doesn't do it because there's so much body camera footage that the prosecutors cannot look at it all. Remember, I said they're ministers of justice. They are supposed to look at the evidence, and if there's not enough evidence, they have to drop it.
That's right.
And they have to point out evidence which might show that the accused did not commit the crime. It's called exculpatory evidence.
Okay.
Or Brady evidence after a case, Brady versus Maryland from the United States Supreme Court. So if they can't diligently, as I said, go through it all and point out all the problems, they're just not going to take responsibility for prosecuting the case at all.
Right.
It's the police officer's job to come in, or if it's a private complaint, like you go, you have your neighbor broke your window and you went down to the magistrate to complain, you would have to present your own evidence.
Okay. Body cameras, is that a zero-sum gain? Is it worth having those, or should we?
Absolutely. Yes.
Okay. Could you say a little bit more about that? Absolutely.
It has two positive effects. Okay. One, sometimes the officers remember they're on camera and they follow the procedures, which we want our police to be. We give them a lot of power and a lot of discretion.
Right.
That their choices that they make are respected. That's why some of these cases where police are prosecuted for shooting somebody are so frustrating, because they have a lot of discretion of judgment in the moment. They're the ones who are out on the line.
Sure.
Dealing with threats of violence at any particular moment. So if they're following all of the rules to respect our rights, the people they're supposed to be protecting and serving, even when they're arresting us, that is good for the customer base, as you will. The other effect is when there is misconduct, it's right there. You don't have to depend on the word of the defendant, who is under the hammer, as it were, and if they don't want to plead guilty to sometimes some very serious charges, they will concoct any story intended to get them out from under, because that's their only path to victory, is if their side is believed. And if there's video, you don't have to make up a story or sustain a convincing narrative. You show the video and it speaks for itself.
Speaks for itself, okay.
Especially if you tell people ahead of time what they're about to see in the video.
Okay, very good. Do you have a definition of creativity?
There's a lot of the practice of law that is routine. As I said, there's a checklist. There's a crime alleged. And if you're going to steal something, you have to take an object and move it with the intention of never giving it back to the person and depriving them of the value of the thing.
Right.
So go through the statute, look at every time, look at all the things the Commonwealth has to prove. Look at the criminal complaint. Does it say all the things that have to be present? You know, there's checklists. So much of the routine is necessary. But sometimes not following the accepted pattern of negotiations and reaching out to the prosecutor means that you come up with a unique solution for that person that addresses the concerns the Commonwealth has. Maybe it's as simple as, we want these two people not to fight anymore.
Mm.
So we won't convict your person of anything, but the judge will say, there's enough evidence to convict, but we're going to put it off for 6 months while everybody calms down. And if there's no more trouble, the case will be dismissed without a conviction. Things like that. Right. And it's looking at the facts and the people and talking to the Commonwealth about what they want and what their victim wants.
Mm-hmm.
The complaining witness in the crime, if you want to use a less loaded word.
Okay.
And sometimes you can get something that everybody is equally unhappy with, I guess is the simplest way to put it, or that is acceptable to everyone anyway.
Exactly.
We're all characters in a story that we're going to be telling later. And you have to ask yourself, what kind of story do I want to be telling 3 years from now about these events?
Okay.
And so if you want to be the hero of that story, you better act the part of the hero and step up. Some people don't want to plead guilty because they know it's going to echo down the family forever that they stole this thing, and they don't want to admit it. Right?
Exactly.
That's the kind of thing I'm talking about.
No, exactly. Exactly. Right?
Or I don't want to explain to every job I ever apply to why I'm guilty of this thing, even though I didn't really do it.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to avoid a conviction.
Okay.
It's that openness to, once you do all the routine and see what are the facts beyond change, now we can begin to get clever and start shifting things around to get as much of what the client wants as possible.
Okay.
And different facts, some cases are worse than others.
Sure.
You're not always dealing with the same prosecutor or the same police officer. The clients want different things. And so it's keeping the big picture, kind of mentally shifting the cards around until you think of something that the Commonwealth would agree to that the client would also accept. Redefining victory every time, that's where the creativity comes in.
Well, very good. No, I appreciate that. It's a nice view. Because oftentimes we look at the law, sometimes it's very dogmatic, just straight by the numbers. But certainly with anything, there's that room. If we bring that to the table, if you, the lawyer, brings that to the table, or the client, there might be some other outcomes that could be had.
We come from a tradition of about 800, 900 years going on of people being jerks.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the laws, and the reason why contracts are so long is because there's a long history of people trying to weasel out of obligations.
Yeah. That's right. That's right.
Right. And there's rules of evidence for a reason, because you don't want people just coming in and saying any old thing in court. Most of the laws have a reason behind them. Seatbelt law, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of meddling in everybody's personal decisions, but more people stay alive for that reason.
Exactly. Yes.
And most laws are like that. They have a rational basis behind them. In the face of all of that, once you get past all those rules, how can we convince the Commonwealth not to drop the hammer? Can we induce in them a spirit of grace and mercy, which is actually how the Supreme Court of Virginia defines it when you put somebody on probation?
Mm-hmm.
The court believes that a certain sentence is appropriate, but they're suspending it out of grace and mercy.
Okay.
And if you don't live up to your end, now we're going to drop the hammer.
Okay. Very good. Right. One last question. And considering your experience with your vision challenges, your experience with law, what would you say as a closing statement to other vision challenged people as they go about their life, deciding their futures?
Pick something you want to change. A small thing. I don't like the toothpaste I'm using. I want cinnamon. Go find cinnamon toothpaste. And now the cinnamon toothpaste clashes with the mint-flavored mouthwash. Go find cinnamon mouthwash. One little thing at a time makes big change. That's an actual thing that I did this winter when I was feeling low. I picked a thing that had been frustrating me for years because my wife was doing all the shopping for that sort of thing. I just went online and started buying my own toothpaste. It doesn't have anything to do with assistive tech, but it's the kind of thing I'm getting at. Each day is full of little annoyances. Some of those are there all the time for a reason. Go find what that reason is and see what you can do to fix it.
Right. I think that's quite important because we are annoyed. We make decisions daily throughout the day, and there are things we can sort of tackle, make decisions on, move out the way. They may give us a sense of peace, exhilaration, or lack of frustration. But it's important to, like you said, knock them out as you come to them, so to speak. Build up those positive results in your life.
And if you're the one picking the changes and picking your battles, they're going to have the best outcome for you because you know your situation best. But also, you will feel the most better because they're problems that you feel the most keenly.
Okay. Very good, Rob. And we're going to leave it right there. Rob, I do appreciate you coming on. I was really excited about having you on simply because you are the first non-art related person or career. And I wanted to provide that full gamut of talent, of creativity that's out there in our lives, in all of our lives. And so, yeah, I appreciate you doing this.
Thank you for having me on.
Okay. For those of you interested in submitting your talent for consideration, call Virginia Voice at 804-266-2477 or email me, Lamont Crowley, at myvoiceforsoul@gmail.com. That is my voice, the number 4, SOL@gmail.com. Or text me at 804-514-5890. Also use that contact information to send us any feedback you may have about this show or Shards of Light in general. I want to offer a special thanks to the Virginia Board for the Blind and Vision Impaired for their generous support. And until we meet again, bright moments.